Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Clap, 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 clap your hands and stomp your feet. You're listening to the Clap Your Hands podcast, hosted by Elliot Shore Parks and Kyle Newbeck. Here they come.
What's going on, everybody? This is the Clap Your Hands podcast, brought to you by Odyssey, brought to you by 94WIP. Download the Odyssey app. You get all the episodes first when you download that, plus all the other great pods that Odyssey has to offer, especially with the NFL playoffs coming up. You know they're going to have that fire NFL content. Obviously, a lot to talk about today, Kyle, but of course, I got to get your Eagles take. I mean, we know the playoff opponent now. You're basically an Eagles writer, too. Got a lot of Sixer stuff, but I need the Eagles take off the top.
I mean, they're going to beat the Giants. Anybody who's showing fear of the Giants this week is just like searching for a reason to draw attention to themselves, I guess. There's this idea out there that sweeping a team because they beat them twice in the regular season, to beat them a third time is really difficult. Historically, the stats say otherwise. I believe teams are like, I want to say like 13-7 or something like that. There was a thing that was put out a few years back. And San Francisco obviously just beat up on Seattle in their matchup. So like, if you think the Eagles are the better team, and they proved that they were over the course of the season, they're going to win. They have home field advantage. Jalen Hurts is ostensibly healthy. They'll not have such a vanilla playbook as they did in the final week, where, you know, it's all backups playing for the Giants. Yeah. So people are panicking that they didn't destroy them. I just think it's overthinking it to say anything other than the Eagles should win relatively comfortably. New York has looked good against Minnesota, but Minnesota had fraud vibes most of the year.
They definitely did.
So that's my take. That's about it.
All right. Well, I think, first of all, I agree with everything you just said. Something tells me Philly fans will find a way to be afraid of the Giants by the end of the week. That's a lot of time between the game to feel confident. But the other question is, and you know, who would have thought a month ago we would ask this, like, are the Sixers the best team in Philly? I'm mostly kidding, obviously, with the Eagles being number one, but man, the Sixers, they're playing awesome, Kyle. I mean, over the weekend, since we last recorded, start the West Coast trip off, the win at Utah, win at LA last night. I know late night for you watching that game. So, you know, probably a little tired, Kyle, to start the pod. But no, I mean, I thought those two wins were unbelievable. And I have one clear takeaway from it. But let me hear what you have to say off those two wins.
So here's my big takeaway. If James Harden is as good as he was in those two games for most of the season, or like most of the playoffs, we'll say, I think they can win the title. Like, that's how good I think he was in these two games. And I think you can clearly see the chemistry and the synergy growing between him and Joel Embiid. And I think some of that is just due to, you know, James, obviously a fantastic playmaker, regardless of how the scoring is going. But when he is on as a scorer, and he's getting to the paint and teams are having to play him to get all the way to the rim, Joel can get, you know, 4, 6, 8 points a game on just wide open dunks that he doesn't have to do basically any work for. He sets a screen, James gets downhill, drop off pass, and Joel's putting a guy on a poster if he has the audacity to challenge him. And so for Joel to get those easy points, that has multiple effects, right? Like, that gives him more energy to exert on the defensive end. I thought we did see some awesome rim protection when he was in position to make plays last night, which we'll get to the defense later. Yeah. And it also, like, Joel's just going to score more points because he's going to win a lot of one-on-one battles. He's going to get his points on, in early offense, on post-ups, on mid-range jumpers. But if you can spoon-feed him, like, 2 or 3 dunks a game, that's a huge deal for a guy who's already scoring, you know, 33 points a game. Or I should say, was scoring 30 points a game last season before these type of shots were a regular part of his diet. So, James, I think you're seeing him get into the teeth of the defense more. He's looked better as a finisher. And obviously, like, I think the three-point shooting is probably a little unsustainable. But we've talked a lot about, you know, James has embraced being an off-ball player more, that he is more comfortable as a catch-and-shoot guy right now. And so the fact that he's able to hurt you in so many ways as both a scorer and a playmaker, and that he looked as good as he did on the second half of back-to-back in L.A., that to me is the most telling thing. Because last season it was a lot of like, all right, James can play one good game, but then if there are any other games close on the schedule, it's like he clearly doesn't have the legs to do this. Like the hammy was holding him back. And so the fact that he's been this good for such a sustained run post-foot injury from basically early December on, with, you know, blips here and there, but largely has been very, very good. That to me is the most important thing that's happened over the last month and a half, we could call it, because – you know, I know the level Joel is at. You know, certainly we have playoff questions that we have for Joel in big time moments and whether you can win with a center as your best player in 2023. But if you get this version of Harden, who's able to walk that line and be a playmaker and be a situational scorer, like he has sort of taken over these beginning of fourth quarter stretches without Joel and either won those minutes outright, or at least they're treading water so that they're not losing ground. And then you bring Joel in for the closing kick. Like, that's a huge deal. And the last couple of nights, despite some issues in the middle of games, they've been able to close teams out and, you know, come up with some big buckets in crunch time, which you and I have harped on them for a lot. Yeah. So I think there's a lot to be encouraged by over the last couple of nights.
I mean, let's call it what it is. This is the James Harden they wanted to trade for. Like, when they made that trade for James Harden, this is what you thought you were getting. And you're getting even more in a way, because you're getting a way better playmaker than I anticipated. And his passing's probably always been underrated part of his game. I mean, he's led the league in assists before, at least been pretty close to it. But so Saturday night when they played the Jazz, I'm at a wedding. And, you know, I'm getting texts, you know, from my friends, just basically Harden, 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 again and again and again. And I checked the highlights out the next morning of the end of it. And let me tell you, there's this clip on Twitter where it shows all of his points in the fourth quarter, 18 fourth quarter points. And I don't want to say it was not safe for work, but like that video was everything young Elliot has been hoping for in a Sixers guard since Iverson left the team. Like, that video was it. Like, I remember when they traded for Harden last year, there was I was watching highlights of him, and, you know, it's Harden drops 55 and you're watching it. And it's just like 3-3 swap, like getting to the line. Right. And that's what he looked like against Utah. I think he maybe had 3 or 4 threes in that quarter. You know, obviously big ones late, 18 points. But what's so impressive about him now is, and obviously, as you mentioned, the 3-point shooting right now, who knows if he can keep it up. I think it's still the second best of his career. So maybe that dips a little. But to me, there's 2 major differences from last year. One, he's just way more aggressive as a scorer. I think he's just trying to score more than he was last year. But the other thing is, I think, and you mentioned this, he just looks healthier. Like, I remember in the preseason game, the first preseason game this year, he came out and I was like, he looks like the same guy to me. I didn't think he looked that different. But as the season has gone on, and he had that time off with the leg injury, he looks like the Harden that he did in Houston, just in terms of how comfortable he looks scoring. What's impressive to me about both him and Joel is when they're really going, they make it look so easy, right? Just Harden gets to the basket, almost looks like he's moving in slow motion, how easily he's getting there right now. And then the passing, the shooting, but you talked about it and it's so true. He's clutch. This is what you need a guard for at the end of games. When they lost to the Pelicans, I talked about how CJ McCollum was able just to walk down the court and just hit threes and take the game over so easily. Harden didn't do that. But in the fourth quarter, Harden was able just to step back, hit threes, get the game under control. And then against the Lakers, you know, wasn't the same type of three-point barrage, but he was a guy you could count on late in that game, and he does a great job distributing. I think that the Harden they're getting right now, it's everything they could have hoped for. And I know we talked about it on the last pod, but it has to be reiterated. He's an A player for them this year. He is, you know, and I want to get into this in a little bit. We could probably count, you know, on our fingers and toes, the amount of players in the NBA that have been better than him this year. That's how good he has been. I think when you combine what he's done as a scorer, what he's doing as a shooter, and the and everything he's giving to offense as a playmaker, this was exactly what the Sixers wanted when they traded for him.
I just think it fundamentally changes the outlook on the team if this is the Harden that they're going to get, right? Like coming into the year, a lot of the thought and the discussion out there is like, all right, is it going to be worth paying James Harden long term? Right. Like they have this year and then they might decide, all right, we had a good run at it, but might be better to move on. Like you can't even consider that right now, the way he's playing. Like this is exactly what you brought him in to do, to be. And like, again, I've said this before. I think one thing he deserves even more credit for is just the idea that he's been able to pick his spots and be the number two guy willingly, without, you know, losing what's making Joel Embiid great. Like Joel's having his best season statistically ever, and probably his best season ever, just period. Like I think he's been that good. And James has been okay with that. Like James, in spite of having these awesome fourth quarter moments and, you know, having some great scoring barrages at points in these games, he is allowing Joel to be the guy. And like there are times, including that Utah game, I thought James had a case to put his hand up and say, no, it's my time. Like, I'm going to go out and hunt my shot because I was that good. But instead, because, you know, it's Joel's team and James seems to recognize that, he allowed Joel to have those moments. And, you know, Saturday night, his trust was rewarded. Joel hits the game winner and makes the game winning defensive play against Utah. And that stuff, like, it seems small to people on the outside, but like, when you're around these guys every day and you know the egos that are involved and all that, like, I know those sort of things make headway. Like, that stuff matters. That guys simply understand this is this guy's team, or like, this guy's the guy and he's who we're going to trust in crunch time, and not allowing that to, you know, change your mentality or make you upset with your role or whatever it is. Like, that's a big part of making a team work. 'Cause like, they clearly have a lot of talent on this team, especially high-end talent between Joel and James. But if they're not willing to work together and, you know, to build something more together, none of that matters. Like, they'll flame out like any number of other Sixers teams. So the progress that I've seen them make as a duo, like, obviously their pick and roll game was great from basically the first game they played together last year. But seeing those two just hammer away, hammer away, hammer away throughout games, where it's those two operating in the middle of the floor and they're just daring teams to try to stop them somehow. Like, it's been really fun to watch them evolve and seeing the little wrinkles that come out of those looks. And, you know, for James to now take this step back toward, like, I'm not going to say he's James Harden from Houston, because I do think there's still an element of physicality that he's probably just not getting back at this stage of his career. But to get closer to that, and to give us at least flashes of, you know, sort of that level of play, that just is transformative for this team if he's able to sustain it.
Well, I think you're right that he's not Houston Harden in the way that Houston Harden did it all game, every game, all season for multiple years. He can't do that now. He just can't, right? He's at the back end of his career. All those things are true. But what I've always felt about Harden was you don't need him to be that Harden all the time. Joel is the guy. As much as we're talking about Harden right now, Joel's the guy. And you're right, against Utah, Harden was playing well enough that he could put his hand up and go, no, I got this. I'll take us home. But ultimately, Joel is the number one on this team. Joel is who's going to take the big shots when they're coming out of timeout 9 out of 10 times. And if Joel's playing his best, they don't need James to be Houston Harden. Where my biggest concern has been, and this is where it comes in, we've talked about Zach LaVine and, you know, trading for guys like that, is when Joel's off, who can they lean on? When Joel isn't being Joel, whether he's hurt, he has a mask on his face, whatever the thing is, it's going to probably pop up in the playoffs. When Joel's not Joel, then can they get Houston Harden? And I think they're showing real signs that Houston Harden can show up now. Now, the playoffs, and we'll say this 1,800 times before the season before the postseason begins. Of course, that's where it'll be decided. But I think it's to the point with Harden where we can go through every team and go, all right, Milwaukee, right? Well, who knows if Chris Middleton will be Chris Middleton in the playoffs? And who knows, you know, Giannis is hurt now. The Nets, Kevin Durant hurt now. Who knows what Kyrie will be up to come postseason time? The Celtics are really probably the only team where you can't super poke a hole in what they're doing. I know Jaylen Brown is hurt now, but they have a rookie head coach, so those are those things. And I know the Sixers playoff failures are why we talk about the postseason so much, but ultimately, if we're going to just say flat out, look at the teams right now, look at how they're playing, look who's had it over a long stretch, Harden and Embiid look like the best duo in the East by far, maybe. And we can get into it now or wait on, but like, I think there's a real argument that that Harden and Embiid could be the best duo in the NBA right now. Like if I'm an opposing defense and I have to go up against a duo, I don't think that there's a more scary one right now than Joel and Harden when you look at what they're doing. Joel in the paint, as much as I hate centers, Joel in the paint, unstoppable. He's hitting his mid-range shot. Harden's hitting his threes. I mean, just the way they're playing together, yes, the postseason will be where it is, but they are playing like the best duo in the NBA right now.
I probably wouldn't put them quite there. I mean, if we're just talking offense and we throw out, like, because, you know, James obviously has his issues on defense, whatever.
But Joel's really good on defense, so that...
Joel is very good on defense, but if we're saying just on offense, like, you probably take KD and Kyrie when they're healthy over these guys. Mm-hmm. Kyrie, obviously, a dog shit defender, so that kind of invalidates, like, the defensive side of the ball. But KD and Kyrie were on, like, an absolute heater of a run before KD got hurt. So I do still have some respect for those guys. These two against Tatum and Jaylen Brown is interesting because, you know, I think Tatum is slightly below Embiid's level. Brown and Harden, I guess it would probably depend on the game. Like, Brown is certainly not giving you as much playmaking, but, you know, the off-ball athleticism and, you know, some of that stuff is pretty impressive. So depends on where, but yeah, when you think about it, they're at least in the conversation, right? And like, that is important because I think coming into the year, you view it more as Joel is up there with any player in the league. And James is probably, you know, let's say top 25, top 30 still in the league. But I don't know where exactly you put him coming into the year. And he didn't have as much scoring juice and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Looking like he has lately and being able to walk that line between, you know, there have been a lot of examples lately where he comes in early in the fourth quarter, and if he's not killing a game off, he's at least going on a positive run with a lot of bench guys, right? Like that Christmas game against the Knicks, that game's very much in the balance. He goes off, and him and George Niang essentially decide the game. The Utah game, he has one of his best scoring barrages of the season. The LA game, he comes in, he sort of settles things down. And as that lineup that was in to start the fourth quarter in LA, Tyrese Maxey, Shake Milton, PJ Tucker, Niang, and Harrell. I don't ever want to see that lineup again.
I'm happy, like, I'll just sleep for that one, not going to lie.
Just horrendous. So that, I mean, that in itself is really bad. So for Harden to come in and sort of stabilize things and get them to a point where they're still in the game, and then Joel comes in the final 5-6 minutes, and now it's time to go win that game. Those runs are super, super important. And like a lot of times in the past, they just haven't had a guy or a lineup to survive those non-Embiid minutes that matter.
Right.
Like the fact that the Sixers were able to hold on and be in a close game, despite the fact that LeBron was on the other team against the, you know, bogus lineup for the most part at the start of that fourth quarter, that's a massive deal. Like, all we've talked about for like half a decade is that, yeah, Joel Embiid's really good, but the second he goes off the floor, the Sixers are fucked, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, they have no chance to win. And so for Harden being able to make a dent in that problem is huge. And Harden being able to thrive in both that context and as a guy who's setting up Joel and scoring off of Joel and all that, like, that's everything you could have asked for when they traded for him. Now, obviously, you know, we could get to April, May, and June, and James might turn into a pumpkin and Joel might get hurt, or, you know, I don't want to make it seem as though these guys have these spotless playoff resumes and we should just blindly trust them that regular season production is the end all be all. But if we're talking about just like a pure midseason vibe check and comparing Harden and how he looks to last year and the chemistry he's got with Joel and the ways they have to beat people, like, they're clearly ahead of where I thought they were at the end of last season. And I think people, like, I don't know why I'm, as a media member who, like, I don't care whether they win or lose anymore. I root for the story more than anything else. But I feel like I'm trying to convince fans that they should be more excited about this team. Like, I get their hangups with Doc Rivers and whatever, but, like, people should be excited about what they're seeing right now. And, well, I feel like there's not, and maybe it's because of the Eagles and whatever else, but there should be a level of excitement for this team and what's happening.
I 100% agree. So we're recording this on a Monday morning. I'm in today on WIP from 2 to 6 for Ike Reese. And obviously we'll be talking a lot of Eagles, but we'll talk about the Sixers, two big wins. And I guarantee you, when I get on the mic and I go, guys, it's time to believe in the Sixers. Doc's doing a good job. Harden looks like the real deal. Embiid, you know, is back in the MVP consideration, all those things. People will push back. Callers will call in and go, well, who cares? It's not until the playoffs. And I get that, but I think you're right that people really are missing out. And there's lots of reasons I'm happy we started doing this pod. But one of them is, you know, you have really opened my eyes to just enjoy things while it's happening. It flat out, enjoy it while it's happening. And as someone that went into this season with so much, I mean, anger is not the right word, but with so much just disappointment in what Harden has been, if you're someone that was like me that felt the way, just now casually paying attention, especially on the West Coast, let's be real. These games are starting, you know, at 9:30, 8 o'clock at night or whatever. Then you're missing out on exactly the player everybody was excited to trade for. Like, when they traded for Harden, there was so much excitement in the city. And then he came in, didn't play well. And I don't blame fans for doing it, but they turned the Sixers off. They were like, well, this team doesn't matter, whatever. But everyone is missing out on exactly what everybody hoped they would be. This is what you hoped Joel and Harden would look like. You talk about the pick and roll game. It's been unstoppable. And what you just said actually made me think of something differently than I have in the past. When you talk about the backup center with the Sixers, that's been a common theme. You know, Joel versus Toronto, when the backup center went in, everything fell apart. You know, Drummond, Harrell, all these guys they've tried, Al Horford. Maybe I was looking at it the wrong way. Maybe other people were too. The issue was never the backup center. The issue is they didn't have a number two. Ben wasn't a good enough number two. Jimmy Butler was at times, you know, but, you know, he wasn't great in some of the Toronto games. They have their number two now, where it doesn't matter who the backup center is because you have somebody else that you can run the offense through. They could never run the offense through Ben Simmons, really. And Butler, they could do it at times, but I don't think he ever played at the level Harden is right now. So they have that guy that they can lean on.
I will disagree in the sense that backup center was and is still a problem. Like, they've had some bad guys there. But to your point, yeah, I mean, and I, in a weird way, like, I'll actually talk about Joel's minutes. Like, in the MVP discussion last year, when they played Denver and they lost to Denver, a lot of Sixers fans hung on to the idea that, like, yeah, Denver won that game, but Joel clearly outplayed Jokic when Jokic was on the floor, was the key thing. Like, lost the game, but in the one-on-one battle, that Joel won that. And I agree with that, but, like, that's too narrow of a way to look at how a basketball game plays out, right? Like, Joel, to win that game and to get further MVP consideration, needed not just to beat Jokic in that game, he needed to really kill Denver's backups. Like, that's your job as the star player. Like, the star battle, if you can win it, great. If you're at least playing that guy to a standstill and then you win the minutes without him, that's how you win games. Joel didn't. Like, Boogie Cousins and Bones Highland destroyed them in a stretch to open the fourth quarter without Jokic on the floor, and they lost that game, and Sixers fans held on to that and were like, well, that has nothing to do with MVP, blah, blah, blah. It's like, of course it does, because Jokic fried any backup lineup the Sixers put on the floor. Mm-hmm. And so those minutes are just as important as, like, I know in the playoffs, stars play 38, 40 minutes a night, right? And those minutes matter because they're the most minutes you're going to play.
Yeah. But
when you have bench guys in, you need somebody, whether that's Joel, whether that's James, most likely in a lot of these cases, that's at least going to help you tread water. Like, if the worst that happens with those backup minutes is that you simply play even with the other team, that's a huge win for the Sixers, because I think their top guys are going to be able to compete with anybody. Like, we've seen James and Joel and how that works, and we've seen them sort of figuring things out even in crunch time, as we've criticized them for, you know, some of the hangups they've had there. So the fact that they're able to now pretty reliably win bench minutes, whether it's Joel on the floor with backups or James on the floor with backups, that is a big deal heading into the playoffs. So I don't know if that point overall made sense to you, but
I think you're right about that. I actually have a quick side tangent based off some of you were talking about with Jokic and the Nuggets. I don't know how much you've had a chance to watch them. I've had a chance to watch a few of their games recently. They look legit. Like, if we're going to talk about the Sixers as a team,
they're very good. Yeah.
Whereas past playoff failures, you kind of throw it out of the window a little bit and talk about what they're playing right now. You brought up Bones Highland, Jokic. They look like, if I look at the teams that I think could legitimately handle the Sixers, I think Denver might be one of them, just with everything that they have. So you're right in talking about, you know, one-on-one last year, Embiid did really well against Jokic, but Denver, I think, was just better than the Sixers were in some ways last year. And I think they look really good this year too. I don't even know if you have to give.
I mean, they have the best record in the West. They're 30-13. Like, they're really good. And as much as I would not vote for Jokic to win a third MVP, barring, like, he would have to put up
his best year though in some ways.
But if they finish first in the West and he's averaging like a triple double as the best player on the team, there's a reason that he's near the top of all these conversations for MVP. Like, considering he has only made one conference finals and has flamed out early other times. Like, I get it. I know people would be irritated by it, but like, that 30-13 is really fucking good. Like, that's,
well, this is why he shouldn't have got it last year, you know, cause now this year, then you could make a legitimate argument for him, frustratingly enough. Quick question. Where do you think Embiid is in the playoff in the MVP race right now? I mean, Jokic ahead of him still?
Where do I think he is versus where do I think he should be? Like, he should be in the top five. I don't know that he is right now because some of this will shake out a little bit differently over these next few weeks because Durant's going to miss time. And so he goes from being like a clear cut edge over Joel just because of games played to he's going to lose all these games. And that makes it so, all right, that's more of a conversation. But I think Tatum is going to get a lot of the, you know, best team, best player, best team love. I think Luka is having a ridiculous year and seems to have an edge over Joel in terms
of people want to give it to him. I think
what the voters want to reward him for. I think Jokic currently has an edge over Joel, even though I think that one should be basically like a toss up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, what's that? Four guys. So yeah, maybe he's the fifth guy in there. I think we're going to see what happens. Like, this is very much a year that I think it will be, it'll come down to like last year. I think it's going to be final month of the season, or the big games, the big moments are probably going to decide this, you know, unless Boston runs away with the Eastern Conference, in which case I think it probably will just go to Tatum. But I also think, you know, of those guys I named, and this is a hot take maybe, I think Tatum's like clearly the worst player of that group. Like, I think I would take all of KD, Embiid, Jokic, over him pretty clearly. I would probably in a normal year take Giannis over him. Although that I think is more of a debate right now. Giannis I didn't even mention, mostly because
Well, he's going to miss
Bucks are struggling. But yeah, so I mean, if Joel's not top five, and Luka, I would definitely take over Tatum. So Joel is, if he's not top five, he's like the sixth guy, but he should be firm top five at this point in the season, in my eyes.
I do wonder if Harden playing really well will hurt Embiid in a way, because Harden, it's going to look like that's, you know, maybe, I don't think Harden's going to get MVP votes. I mean, who knows, if he keeps playing this well, maybe he gets in that top 10 conversation, but I do wonder if that'll end up hurting him. I made a list last night of guards and forwards I think you could argue have been better than Harden this year, or slash Harden's been better than. I want to throw it by you. I'm just curious to see how you feel about it. So these are guys that, so Luka definitely been better than Harden this year. KD, when he's played, has been better than Harden. Donovan Mitchell.
I take Mitchell over him because he's got a much tougher job than James as like the guy on offense. Mm-hmm. And he's been really good. But I don't know what Mitchell looks like next to Joel. Like, I don't know how that works. That's a tough.
I think he's a better scorer, but Harden, I think, is a way better playmaker for the people around
him. Yeah, for sure.
Tatum, I think we both agree, has had a better year. Although, I don't know. I feel like he's falling off a little bit. Am I wrong in that kind of, you know, macro?
I think he's been great. I think that's mostly like there was a bit of a blip for the Celtics, but now they're sort of back on track. Yeah.
Steph Curry.
Ooh. Well, I mean, that's the one where games played works, and I guess it doesn't work in their favor because James missed the month. I'd still take Steph, but
yeah. All right. Ja Morant.
I actually have not looked at Ja's numbers in a while. Comparable. So, I probably lean toward the younger guy, mostly because he's also more exciting to watch than James.
Yeah. But to your point, you know, like Harden's numbers are impacted, but I'd be interested to know what Harden would average if he wasn't playing with Embiid. Like, could he get up to 28, 29 points? He kind of looks
maybe,
like
maybe. I mean, that's easier said than done, obviously. Like, I do think some of his scoring is really aided by the fact that teams are so scared of Joel that they give him, you know, runways to the lane. But like, he still has to take advantage of those. Like, that's,
yeah.
And that was not a thing he did last year, whether he was unable to or unwilling to. So, seen a big step forward from him.
The last few I have, I'll just say all their names. You can tell me. I think he's better than Lillard. Kyrie is tough. Kyrie's so good as a scorer. Brunson, Booker, De'Aaron Fox, and McCollum were like, I was stretching at that point.
I mean, I would take him pretty easily over most, if not all those guys. And then Kyrie is an interesting one, but I'll ding him for the anti-Semitism and say Harden was better. How about that?
That's probably a fair thing when making the list. All right, so I think we've successfully talked about how good Embiid and Harden has been. And, you know, it shouldn't be overstated. When we first started the pod, we didn't feel this way. Or at least I know I definitely didn't. So it's been very fun and exciting to watch them play much better. But arguably the big news, you know, in terms of just team construction and roster, is they bench Maxey. I mean, there's no other way to put it. They bench Maxey against the Lakers. Healthy, came off the bench. Shout out to Sixers beat writer Rich Kaufman that was, I guess, in LA talking to Doc Rivers and said that apparently Maxey called Doc Rivers to say that he wanted to come off the bench. Maybe I'm paraphrasing here, but I think that's kind of the vibe, or at least he was open to it. It's something we have talked about a lot. It's becoming a theme of the season of what do you do with Maxey. They did it. They pulled him off the bench. They kept Tucker in the lineup, started Melton. Melton didn't have a great game. I don't think he scored actually a single point. Maybe he ended up with two, but
yeah, the funny part is neither Melton nor Maxey played well in this game. So it was like the worst of both worlds.
I mean, Maxey did, I think, get up to 16 points, but he did not shoot the ball well against the Lakers. So what do you think about the fact that Melton is starting and Maxey is on the bench and they actually did it?
So first of all, I wasn't there in LA, but I'm very curious if this is a situation like we saw when Doc said, oh yeah, we practice zone every day. And then Tobias Harris got asked about it. And he said, yeah, mm-hmm. we never play zone or practice zone. And it was like a direct, like, I'll be curious to see what Tyrese says about this when I'm able to talk to him next. But
yeah,
I think this touches on something we discussed previously where it's like, of anybody on the team, I think Tyrese is best suited personality wise to take a step back and say, you know, I'll do whatever it takes for the team. He clearly didn't suffer in terms of, you know, raw minutes played. And he was the one who got to play crunch time, closing time, rather than Melton in last night's game. So, you know, that's noteworthy on its own that, you know, even if Melton got the start and Tucker got the start, eventually they're closing with Tyrese and George Niang, the latter of which was pretty controversial at the time, but he ends up making the biggest shot of the game and the biggest defensive player of the game, weirdly enough.
Defensive player especially noteworthy with him.
I mean, that was more Russell Westbrook being an absolute maniac than anything else.
Yeah, he looks out of control in LA when he plays. Like, just not been good.
And he was actually good for most of last night. Like, one of the best Russ games I've seen this season. That's damning with faint praise. So here's what I would say. This does show why I think Doc has probably gotten a little too much criticism this year. I believe he also said last night that they're going to have probably three different starting groups.
Yes,
they're going to rotate through them moving forward. And that in itself is something we would not have seen Doc do in the past, right? Like, that's the sort of thing that we would get on Doc for, that they just play their lineup no matter what. And it's set in stone. They do things the same way. It doesn't matter who the other team is, who they have to guard, how they're going to attack the other team. The fact that Doc is here saying, we probably have three different lineups that we'll go to and we'll shuffle through, that in itself is a big development. It's a
good point.
It's a step away from who Doc has been historically as a coach. Now, whether those lineups all include PJ Tucker or not is maybe the bigger deal, because he again had a disaster of a game in LA after having a disaster of a game in Utah. And the fact that PJ is not closing in a game where that's like one of the most obvious, this is who you brought PJ in to defend games of the season. Like, LeBron obviously still looks amazing for his age, but is the, like, the body type, the profile of guy that PJ's here to guard. And instead they play George Niang in crunch time. Yeah. Like, that says a lot about where PJ's at right now and sort of the trust level that, that Doc has in him. On the other hand, that's another example of Doc saying, you know, look, I'm not going to go with the guy who's the name guy, the bigger contract guy, for legacy purposes, that because PJ was good last year or 2 years ago, I'm going to play who I think gives us the best chance to win in this moment, who's making life easier for our stars. And so by extension of that, that's the same philosophy for the starting lineup. Like, what is the best lineup we can put on the floor that's going to get the best out of Joel Embiid and James Harden? If that's D'Anthony Melton one night, great. If that's Tyrese Maxey the next night, great. The fact that they're at least willing to try these different things is, I think, super important. And, you know, I give Doc credit for that, despite the fact that I thought their defensive game plan last night in LA was absolutely ridiculous.
And not a fan,
you
know, of it.
Maybe we can get that to that at some point. But
yeah,
I think this is a good sign. And if we take it for what it is on the surface and say that, you know, Tyrese is a willing participant in this and that this isn't causing any sort of locker room issue, I also think, you know, as much as we're talking about the basketball merits of it, I think it's smart to come out and say, you know, we're going to move through these different lineups, because that's a politics thing as much as it is a basketball thing. You can go to Tyrese, or maybe more importantly, Rich Paul and the people around Tyrese, and say, look, this is not a demotion. This is not Tyrese got hurt and is now being sent to the bench permanently. This is just something we're going to do to mix and match and be the best version of ourselves every night. Like, there is a little bit of PR spin to it that comes with that. And, you know, I think that's probably a savvy move from the team to set it up that way.
I do think it's a little bit like with the Eagles, with their defensive ends, they rotate, they all play snaps. And they're, you know, in 2017, it was very much like this because they didn't have an elite edge rusher, but it was, they were all starters, quote unquote. We don't have starters. It's just whoever's out there on the first snap is who is out there. And this year you're seeing that as well. I mean, Brandon Graham, double digit sacks, not a starter, quote unquote. But I think that's a different situation than a starting five in an NBA game. I think there's just more merit to starting. I give Tyrese credit if he's actually saying, the best thing is for me to come off the bench. If you think that, I'm willing to do it. I give him a ton of credit for doing that, because I think going to the bench, no matter how people try to spin it, there has to be some level of, I don't want to say like a moral blow or anything, but you're not the starter. I think in the NBA, being a starting player really does truly matter. Now, we've talked about this, and I think it's a great point. PJ Tucker gives you nothing off the bench. So that's the tough thing, is that you bring him off the bench and there's nothing there. Last night when I was watching the game, and you know, I was texting some of my friends and saying, man, it's so dumb they're not starting Maxi. Well, when they brought Maxi off the bench, there was an exciting element to it of, all right, now they have Maxi coming in. He's a change of pace guard. He can really run. He can shoot. So there's those components of bringing him off the bench is a weapon in a ways, whereas PJ is not that. And at the end of games, I do think he'll be in. I think right now, as frustrating as it is that PJ is going to start, because I don't think he's one of the best five players, I think you can get by with it. It's regular season. You're trying different things. I agree with you on the politics thing about saying we have three different starting lineups for sure. That's why he did it. My concern is just long-term. Maxi, for as, you know, as great of a person as he might be and as unselfish as he's being, there is no way he is going to be a rotating starting player in for the Sixers. And, you know, right now you can maybe convince Rich Paul into it. You can convince Maxi to be happy about it, even if he suggested it. It's not going to be something they can do for a year or two. But maybe we shouldn't worry about those problems until down the line. And just say for now, it seems to be, to your point, a good solution to, you know, maybe a good problem. I don't know if it's a good problem to have, but certainly something they have to figure out.
So a few things I want to touch on there. Like the football comparison is important, right? Because if you're going to rotate defensive ends, you can have a guy who plays on first down and then immediately bring someone in on second down. Like it's easy to just say, guys are shuffling in and out. Like we're just getting fresh bodies out there as much as we can. You can't do that in basketball. It's all about one, stoppages, two, guys getting into a rhythm on offense and having to play extended periods of time. It's not as simple as, you know, we're bringing somebody in as like a third down edge rusher, that they're a get to the quarterback type guy versus a more of a complete or run stopping guy like Brandon Graham has been throughout his career. You can't do that. It's not the same in that way. Like you can make offense, defense subs late in games, but by and large, that's like very situational basketball. That's not something you're going to do, you know, throughout a game or certainly in the middle quarters. And then I agree with you, like as much as I think Tyrese is this great kid and probably is best suited for this on the team, eventually, you know, he's going to say, you know, I want a bigger opportunity. I deserve a bigger opportunity. And he's going to hear things like that from his agent, from his family. And I don't mean this is not criticism. His family is awesome. And you can tell that he was raised by like a great set of parents and he has good people around him, but like, they're going to say to him at some point, like, look, son, like you probably deserve more.
Yeah. 100%.
And you hear those things from people that you love and trust and care about, like that gets in your head. Like, I think that's what people probably don't really think about that much. It's like, even if Tyrese goes into this with the absolute best mindset possible, and, you know, maybe there's a pie in the sky scenario where he looks at this as he can be like the Manu Ginobili of the Sixers. And however realistic.
Lou Williams. I always actually thought he compared to Lou Williams as a six man type of guy. Like just coming.
But I just mean in the sense that like he is willing to do it as like this is what's best for the
championship.
Despite the fact that I am definitely one of the five best players on this team.
Yeah,
that's more the Ginobili thing that I'm getting.
And probably top three.
Right. So even if he's willing to take that approach, other people are going to get in his head to some degree. Like you have to be a really mentally strong person to hear things coming from, whether that's the people around you, fans, media members, whatever it is. Like it takes a lot to be able to withstand that over the long term and not grow at least somewhat dissatisfied with where you're at. Like not every guy is suited to do that. Now, maybe Tyrese is, maybe he just gets paid and like none of this stuff matters. Like, you get a big time contract and you're the sixth man, but you still play over 30 minutes a game and play in crunch time. Like you could definitely say, yeah, it doesn't matter if he starts or comes off the bench at that point. But getting to that point is important, and making sure that, you know, everyone stays in the boat is important. On the other side of that too, like, we're viewing this through Tyrese's eyes because of how the lineup was last night. Imagine you're D'Anthony Melton, and like, you have that run all throughout November and December where, yeah, as the fifth starter, you're playing really well individually and the team plays great. And Tyrese comes back and you get demoted and you're in this sort of swing role where you're going back and forth between starting and closing. Doesn't close at all last night, is off the floor for their important crunch time reps. Like, that in itself is another big deal. And Melton is not the one who's going to get probably a big money extension in the offseason. Like, he's going to play another year at $8 million a year. And so he's got that in his mind. Like, I need to have a huge 2023-24 because I should be headed toward a big payday in 2024, whether that's for the Sixers or elsewhere. So yeah, there is a lot of saying ego management makes it seem like these guys have like ego problems, but it, like, they rightfully are going to say, I'm very good at basketball. I've been a big producer for this team in the way that I am, and I deserve these opportunities. And, you know, you look at PJ and what he's doing, and there might be resentment building up at some point. So
yeah,
I think that's all things that you have to keep in mind over the long term. And, you know, we'll see how this shakes out. I do think it lends some credence too to the idea, like, maybe you do have to explore trades at some point with Tyrese, as much for like his long-term benefit and long-term desire as it is like making the team better. But that's, well, you know, if they can find a workable version of this group, they'll do that before they trade them.
Well, and the, you know, you talk about trading, you know, you want to make sure it doesn't get to a point where those guys are asking to be traded, right? Yes. I mean, I'll give another Eagles analogy here since, you know, it's playoff time and I guess they're on my mind, but think about Devontae Smith, right? Devontae Smith on his rookie deal was the number one receiver last year. AJ comes in. Now, Devontae still put up really big numbers. So they've gone above and beyond to make sure, you know, Devontae's a number one for us. He's, well, all those things are true, right? The end of the day, Devontae needs to get paid. Maxey needs to get paid. Melton needs to get paid. PJ's been paid. PJ got a deal he probably could have never dreamed of. AJ Brown got his $100 million deal. The reality is, when these athletes that have not been paid are taking back seats, we can, you know, Devontae, such a great guy. And it's true. Devontae wants to win, you know, all these things. Maxey, great people around
him. It's still a career. Like, it's still a job.
Right. It's still there. When you're an athlete, you have 2 to 3 chances throughout your career to get paid, like to get your deal, right? So the Eagles can be happy that Devontae is happy now. Bottom line is, unless Devontae gets a number one receiver contract, he's going to go somewhere where they will pay him like a number one receiver. Maxey and Melton. Now, they might Maxey out, and we talked about this on the last pod, just to do it. And so maybe this is not going to matter. But if it's 30 games of this, 40 games of this, you know, people around Maxey are going to say, look, don't mess up your contract here, because the Sixers can say one thing now about, yeah, you know, we're going to pay you anyway. Don't worry about it. And blah, 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 blah. But if they could do 30 games, him coming off the bench and things are going great and Melton's playing well, it's just human nature to go, all right, maybe we don't actually have to max you out. And to Melton's point, he even more so, because he doesn't have a guaranteed contract. Maxey's isn't actually guaranteed, but we both agree he's going to get it. Melton does not have that. So you're right about maybe exploring them to avoid a future problem, but it's also going to be really tricky to avoid a situation where Melton's team is going, you know what, trade me, because I have to get somewhere where I'm going to get paid. I have to. And the question I would have for you as someone that's around them more, what do you think PJ would feel about coming off the bench? We talked about how Maxey would feel, how Melton would feel. What about PJ? The Sixers overpaid him, right? He's close with James Harden. You know, all these, I mean, could he be considered to come off the bench, or is the basketball part of it probably not going to make that happen?
I mean, I don't think he would like it. I will say he hasn't.
Throw the biggest hissy fit, I guess. It was, yeah, probably.
I don't think, though, you know, like, if you look at how things have played out this season, it's not like he's expressed a lot of dissatisfaction, despite the fact that he's getting benched in crunch time. I'd say probably at least like 50% of these games, right? Like, yeah, there are a lot of games where PJ's just not playing the minutes that matter. And I can't imagine he loves that, but he hasn't made a stink about it. Is, you know, saying all the right things about this is, he's doing whatever he needs to do for the team, whether that's starting, finishing, playing with bench lineups, playing center, all that. So I do give credit to all the guys involved in this, you know, potential debate, that none of them has stepped out of line yet. They've all said the right things. They've all carried themselves as good teammates. Again, it always comes back to what happens when there's real adversity for this team. What happens when Tyrese plays in crunch time over Melton and he misses like six straight shots, and Melton or Melton's representation or Melton's friends or Melton's family say, yo, this is BS, dude. Why are you not playing over this guy? Mm-hmm. Or what happens when Melton is out there ostensibly for defensive purposes and he just gets roasted over and over again by a really good player, and Tyrese's people say, well, Tyrese could do that and also give you more on offense. Like, that's the stuff that you have to worry about. Like, if they're losing big time games, playoff games, and one of them's not on the floor, and they say, hey, look, you guys still lost that game and I'm not playing. Like, what am I doing here? What are we doing here? Like, that's when you have to worry about it. If they just win, that solves everything. Nobody's worrying about their role. Guys are still playing 30 minutes a night, making good money, playing on a really good team. If they win and they settle into roles, that solves everything. My concern is, you know, that sets a really high bar. You have to win 50 plus games, maybe 55 games, and go to a conference finals at least for everybody to feel satisfied with where they're at. And that's a really, really tough thing to accomplish, even with all we've said about how positive we feel about this team right
well,
now.
And really quick, I mean, it's easy for Maxi and the team to do this when the game starts at 10 o'clock at night. The Eagles just, you know, like, let's be real. If you don't talk about a PR aspect, nobody really cares right now about it. Like, people close to the team do, obviously, and Maxi's people. But labels matter. And when game 7 of round 2 is being played and Maxi's not a starter or Melton's not a starter, or they're using whichever line, like, they can pretend they have three starting lineups now, they're more than likely going to start the exact same five players throughout the playoffs, I would think. I would be surprised if they didn't. So that's really when it's going to matter. That's really when it's going to be tested to, okay, game 7 tonight, must win game, biggest game of Joel's career, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Maxi, you're coming off the bench. Or PJ, I know we signed you, but you're not starting tonight. That's when it's truly going to matter, when those moments arrive. How do you think Doc will handle it? Because I think when it comes to Doc's star management, there's kind of different things out there. Now, he's coached a lot of them throughout his career. Boston, LA, now here with Philly. And it feels like in LA, the whole perception was he let them do whatever they wanted. How do you think Doc will be managing these personalities and handling what we seem to agree is going to be, could potentially become at least a somewhat tense situation, and at the very least is a tricky one?
I mean, that's sort of the million-dollar question, right? Is he gets a lot of credit for, I'd say, ego management and, you know, setting guys in roles and establishing a hierarchy. That went tits up when the Kawhi and PG,
I haven't heard that expression.
Kawhi and PG Clippers were just sort of a complete disaster internally. Yeah. And as you're mentioning, he let them get away with pretty much whatever they wanted. So, like, I'm not worried about PJ, because if he gets mad, like, who cares? He's not good enough for me to really care about him.
But he seems like a personality that if he's upset in the locker room could be destructive. Like, if the positive is he has this dog in him, blah, blah, blah. Well, the negative side of that is he is somebody that cares a lot and is not just going to sit back.
I don't think he's that sort of guy, though. Like, I think so. He was, if I'm remembering correctly, I feel like he was a military brat growing up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that sort of informs his personality in a way. He's like, you know, what's good for the group is good for me. Like, that sort of mentality. Like, right, I'm going to do whatever. Like, I don't know if it's, I wouldn't say that's all because of his upbringing, but I do think there's something to that where, like,
well, he's at a late stage of his career too, for what it's worth.
Yeah. I just think he grew up in a house and a mentality that it's like, you know, the word of the law goes, or it's like whatever my dad or my parents are telling me goes. And so, an extension of that is the coaching staff, or, like, you know, if boosting up one of my teammates or my my people around me is better for the group, then I'm willing to take that back seat. Now, again, I don't think he'll be happy. I don't think he's going to sit there and be, you know, like a church mouse and not say anything or whatever. But I don't think he is the type of guy that's going to like burn down a locker room because he's playing less minutes. The concerns for me are all the younger, long-term guys. Like, does DeAnthony Melton just say, I want out? Or not even I want out, but start looking in free agency toward other teams rather than he's somebody they really should want to sign long-term after next year. Or, I mean, if they could ink him to an extension sooner than that and get him on a discount, like that would be the best option.
Now, I don't think he's completely taking locked in for next year. It's not a player option, a team option.
No, like he's under, on an $8 million contract for next year too. Whether they can get him to agree to a longer term deal is another story. I tend to think he's, because he's on a team friendly deal now, and because the cap is going to go up by a ton, he's going to unrestricted free agency in the summer of 2024, basically no matter what. Mm-hmm. So you want to be able to go to him and credibly say, look, we've given you the biggest opportunity you could get here.
Yeah.
We want you to be a core member of our team moving forward, blah, 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 because that will be powerful in negotiations. It's, you know, grass is not always greener on the other side. So they want to go in with that. And same thing with Maxey. Like, even though they're probably going to pay him a ton of money or he's going to demand a lot of money, you still want to be able to say and maybe ding that price tag a little bit by saying, look, Tyrese, you're going to have a huge role here. You saving us some money. It's going to allow us to, you know, retain some other guys, whatever it is. Now, Rich Paul's probably telling him to screw off. And
I was going
to
say, first it was Maxey, it'd be so great if you come off the bench for us. Now it's Maxey, if you could just take a little less money for us.
So it's a very tricky thing to sort of sort out. But you want to go into those conversations with as good of a relationship as possible. And so I'm not worried about keeping PJ happy. I'm worried about keeping Tyrese and DeAnthony happy.
Well, all right. So let me ask you. So it was $1 million question for Doc. I'll throw the $1 million question at you. You are in the position to make these decisions, the starters, you know, bench, all those things. And you, the long-term implications, the immediate implications, how would you handle it? Like, would you handle it this way? Would you do the three starters thing? How would Kyle Newbeck, head coach / GM, handle this situation?
This is about as best, it's probably the best way you can handle it. I would lean toward playing the three guard starters as much as possible, because I do think, as we've seen with these closing groups, at the end of the day, PJ's probably not going to play a lot of these minutes that matter at this point. Like, based on his current form, even when they're playing teams that he should be playing crunch time against, and he hasn't been good enough to play those minutes. Right. So that means you have to prepare the rest of the group that this is the team, this is the five-man lineup you're going to war with when it matters. It's James, Tyrese, DeAnthony, Tobias, Joel. And so you have to know, DeAnthony, these are your defensive rebounding responsibilities. Like, you have a lot more on your plate there because Tyrese is small, Tobias not the best power forward rebounder. Mm-hmm. And James kind of is what he is there. Joel has his issues there. So DeAnthony has to be prepared for that. You have to prepare Tyrese. Like, you're the guy who's going to have to set our pace in transition. He's going to be leaking up the floor, being that outlet up the floor after they get a stop. Their crunch time offense, where are guys stationed? Who's spacing here? Who's in the corner? Who's doing this? Like, those are all things you have to figure out between now and, you know, mid to late April when the playoffs start. So I would lean into that as much as possible. I don't think, to Doc's point with the three different starting lineups, I don't think it's a group you can play against everybody. They are going to need PJ. So I do agree with the fact that they're, you know, taking this approach and doing this for both basketball and political reasons. But
yeah,
we're going to see how it works out, man. It's a very interesting subplot now as we hit the second half of the year.
Well, and also, you know, maybe we were just early on it, but it feels like it's becoming a real thing. I think when we were first starting to talk about it, it was, oh, this would be interesting. How would they handle, you know, it's becoming a real thing. You know, when you talk about, and really it's becoming a real thing because James is playing so well, and Joel and James playing so well makes secondary issues seem like larger ones. But this is probably the biggest question with the team right now is, how do you handle Maxey? And, you know, the trade deadline less than a month away. I don't think this is something that's going to come to full kind of like full blown issue before the trade deadline. But if a star does become unexpectedly available, that adds a dynamic to it as well. So moving forward, still on the West Coast, three more out West, if I'm not mistaken. Who do they have next? I know it's Tuesday night, but
Clippers, Blazers, Kings, I believe is the next three.
So James Harden getting to spend a lot of time in LA over these next.
Oh, years. I mean, this Clippers game has potential to be like an all-time disaster performance from the team. If they come out and look good in that game, that might be a sign that the Sixers are for real. Like, oh man, they survived the full 4-day trip to LA with two wins. Like, that would be a pretty big deal. So
100%. I mean, look, even coming off the Utah thing back to back to come off and do that was impressive, impressive restraint by James Harden. So I guess just to wrap it up, my question would be these next three games, you know, anything you're looking for, if you want to talk about Doc's defensive strategy for a few minutes, I'll give you the final minutes of the pod to talk about.
I think we'll save that for, we're probably doing at least one more pod this week, if not two more based on how the schedule falls. So
yeah,
I think we can save defense for another day.
But another one.
I'm just looking, you know, more of this version of James Harden, more crunch time execution, which was very good last two plays of the Utah game, and certainly for most of the stretch run against the Lakers. We will not be talking about the Kings game until long after that one's over on Saturday, because that's the day of Eagles Giants. So that takes priority for both of us on that day. But yeah, if they get at least two out of three, Portland has historically been a house of horrors for them on the road, though I do think that that's a winnable game. They're just not very good. That's a team they should punish. And Sacramento to end the trip is a little bit of a tricky one, but they're definitely better than. If they can come out of this with at least two wins, if not all three, and go on an undefeated road trip, then they get several days off before playing the Durantless Brooklyn Nets. And you know, what a
and Simmons.
What an opportunity that's going to be.
Well, did you see real quick, there was a Kyrie quote. I don't have the tweet in front of me, but it was something about how it's nice to play where someone doesn't have their foot one half in, half out of the locker room. It was like an obvious shot at James saying that last
year.
Yeah,
but it's also, it's the, have you ever seen the meme? It's SpongeBob looking around and there's a wanted poster behind him, and it's on the wanted poster is SpongeBob.
Yes, like, yes, yeah.
That's Kyrie saying that. It's like,
yeah.
Well, bro, you skip half the year because you wouldn't get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's like the definition of 1 foot out. But, you know, it is kind of interesting they feel that way about James. So that'll be good. And that's in Brooklyn or in Philly?
That's in Philly. And then they have next week's going to be a fun one for us because it's Brooklyn and then it's Denver on Saturday. So
Wait, so has Joel played against Ben in a regular season?
No.
I don't think so.
No, because Ben sat out the one last year and then
Joel.
So no juice for the last game. Like, that was the disappointment of the last Brooklyn meeting. A home Brooklyn Nets meeting against Ben Simmons with Joel on the floor is a huge deal. So
I've thought about this with Carson Wentz too. Like, Philly sports, the two biggest sports quote unquote villains, and you know, they're people. I'm not actually saying they're villains, but they're sports villains. We have not gotten a Carson in Philly game that mattered, and we have not gotten a Ben in Philly game that mattered. So I feel like, look, Joel, I understand you don't have to do it all for this. You got to play. You got to play, Joel. I don't think they play the night before, if I'm not mistaken. Joel's got to play.
Oh, they have like three nights off before the Brooklyn game.
Joel, you got to play in this game. Ben, you got to play. Philly deserves it. I'm excited for that one now. I forgot about that. I was thinking so much about the James Harden thing.
We got a lot to get to this week before that, but yeah, that's
I'm already looking
forward a little bit.
And the other part of this is, look, if the Eagles lose to the Giants, there could be a lot of attention on that game out of nowhere. So, but neither of us seem to think that is going to happen. All right, this pod I think has come to an end. I will plug the Odyssey app once again. Everybody download it. Episodes get there first. And like I said, all the great NFL stuff that's going on right now with the playoffs, you'll get all those podcasts as well. As Kyle said, we will be back, I think maybe even Wednesday, depending. I think it's going to be a little more pods for us this week. Maybe we can get Saturday morning, get Kyle some sleep on Saturday morning. So we will be back. We'll see. Exactly. We'll see. With this team, you never know. But we shall be back. Thank you again, everybody who listened. This has been the Clap Your Hands Podcast, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
See you guys.